This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Spiritual Ground of Education. This is Lecture 3, entitled The Spiritual Ground of Physical Education, given on August 18, 1922. Today I need to add to what I said yesterday about the old ways to spiritual knowledge. Another example of this is the path of self-denial, as practiced in previous times, or asceticism in the broadest sense of the term. I will describe a path that is even less practical these days than the one described yesterday. The thoughts and customs of our civilization are different from those when people sought high spiritual knowledge through asceticism. Consequently, just as we need to replace the way of yoga with something more purely spiritual and soulful today, the way of asceticism must also be replaced by a modern path. But we can more easily comprehend the modern path to spiritual life if we focus on understanding the way of asceticism. Asceticism is essentially a matter of certain exercises, and these may extend to spiritual and soul matters. For now, I would like to deal with the way these exercises were used to eliminate the human body from all of human experience in a particular way and at certain times. This experience of spiritual worlds is invoked only by eliminating the body. Such exercises consisted of training the body through pain, suffering, and mortification until it could endure pain without disturbing the mind too much, and the ascetic could bear physical suffering without the mind and soul being overwhelmed. Mortification and enhanced endurance were pursued because, as a matter of experience, if the physical was repressed, one's spiritual nature emerged and brought about direct spiritual perception. Although such methods are not to be recommended today, it is a matter of experience that to the degree the physical body is suppressed, one is able to receive soul and spirit. It is simply a fact that spirit becomes perceptible when physical activity is suppressed. Let me make myself clear with an example. Think of the human eye, EYE. It is there to transmit impressions of light to a human being. What is the only way the eye can make light perceptible? Imaginatively expressed, it does this by wanting nothing for itself. As soon as the eye wants something for itself, so to speak, the eye loses its vitality. Perhaps opacity or hardening of the lens or eye occurs. It no longer serves human nature. The eye must claim nothing for its own sake. This is intended figuratively, of course, but things must be stated in a somewhat concrete way for the sake of expression. Thus we could say that the eye owes its transparency to the fact that it shuts itself off from the human being and becomes selfless. So, if we want to see into the spiritual world, we must, as it were, make our whole organism into an eye, in a spiritual soul sense. We must make our whole organism transparent, not physically, as do the eyes, but spiritually. The body must no longer be an obstacle to our interaction with the world. I am not saying that our physical organism, as it exists today, would become diseased, as the eye would be, if it claimed life for its own. In terms of ordinary life, our physical organism is quite all right as it is. It must be opaque. In the lectures that follow, we will see why our organism cannot become an eye in ordinary life, and why it must not become transparent. Our ordinary soul life can rest in our organism only because it is not transparent, because we are not aware of the whole spiritual world when we look around. So, for ordinary life, it is proper and normal for our organism to be opaque. Nevertheless, we cannot perceive the spiritual world through it, just as we cannot know light through an eye with a cataract. When the body is mortified by suffering and pain and self-denial, it becomes transparent. And, just as it is possible to perceive the world of light when the eye lets light flow through it, Likewise, it is possible for the whole organism to perceive the surrounding spiritual world when we make the organism transparent in this way. What I just described occurred in ancient times and led to the powerful religious visions handed down to us by tradition. They are not the independent discoveries of people today. This is what led to the bodily asceticism I have tried to describe. Today, we cannot imitate such asceticism. In earlier times, it was accepted that if one sought enlightenment and wished to know the suprasensory spiritual world, one would join solitary individuals and withdraw from life. It was a universal belief that one could learn nothing from those who lived ordinary life in the world. Knowledge of spiritual worlds could be gained only in solitude, and one who sought such knowledge had to become different from others. It would be impossible to think like this from our modern perspective. We tend to believe only in a person who can stand firmly on 2 feet, one who can help others and who counts for something in life, one who works and trades and is worldly. The solitude that was considered a prerequisite of higher knowledge in previous ages has no place in our view of life. Today we believe only in a person of action, one who enters life and never retires from it. So it is impossible to acquire an ascetic state of mind in relation to knowledge, and we cannot learn of spiritual worlds in this way. Because of this, we must approach clairvoyance through soul-spiritual methods, without damaging our bodily fitness through ascetic practices. And we can do this, because we have gained exact ideas through 100 years of natural scientific development. We can discipline our thinking through natural science. I am not describing something that is antagonistic to the intellect. Intellectuality must be the basis and foundation of clear thinking. And we must build something that can lead to the spiritual world upon the foundation of this intellectuality. Today people easily meet the requirement to think clearly. That is not intended to belittle clear thinking. But in an age that comes several centuries after Copernicus and Galileo, clear thinking is almost natural. The real pity is that it is not yet natural among the majority. Indeed, it is easy to be clear at the expense of thinking fully. Empty thoughts easily become clear. But the foundation of our future development must be clear thinking that is full of meaning. Now, what the ascetic attained by mortification and by suppressing the physical organism, we can attain by taking charge of our own soul development. At some point in life, for example, we can ask ourselves about the sort of habits we have acquired, or about our characteristics, faults, sympathies, or antipathies. And when we have reviewed all this clearly, we can try to imagine, beginning with something simple, what we might be like if a different kind of sympathy or antipathy were developed in the soul. These things do not arise automatically. It can take years of inner work to do what life would do for us otherwise. If we look honestly at ourselves, we have to admit that we are more than we were 10 years ago. The inner form and substance of the soul have become quite different. Now, what has caused this? It is life itself. We have unconsciously surrendered and plunged into the flow of life. And now, can we ourselves do what life would otherwise do? Can we look ahead, for example, to what we might become in 10 years, set it as a goal, and then proceed with iron will to make it happen? If we can encompass all life within our own I, capital, the vast life that otherwise affects us, and if we can concentrate within our will the power that is usually spread out as the sea of life, then we can influence our own progress and make something out of ourselves. Thus within our own being we can achieve the same thing that an ancient ascetic accomplished externally. The ascetic rendered the body weak, and thus the will and cognition would arise from the weakened body, and the body could become translucent to the spiritual world. We must make the will strong and strengthen our thought forces so that they can become stronger than the body, which goes its own way. Thus we constrain the body to become transparent to the world of spirit. We do the exact opposite of the ascetics of ancient times. I covered these things in title How to Know Higher Worlds. What I described there differs completely from the old ascetic way, but many people have confused it with asceticism. They have taken it as the old asceticism in a new form. But anyone who reads it carefully will see that it is different in every way from the asceticism of the past. The new, in quotes, asceticism does not require us to withdraw from life and become hermits. Rather, it keeps us active in the world, and it is achieved only by looking away from the passing moment to time itself. Consider, for instance, what you will be like in 10 years. This means that you must consider the whole span of human life between birth and death. People tend to live in the moment, but here the goal is to live in time, within the whole span of life. The world of spirit thus becomes visible to us. We do indeed see a spiritual world around us once the body has thus become transparent. For example, everything described in my title Outline of Esoteric Science is based entirely on such knowledge, which is obtained while the body is as transparent to spirit as the eye is transparent to light. Now you might agree with what I've said, but argue that we cannot require such spiritual cognition of everyone before becoming a teacher. As I said about yoga yesterday, let me say again that this is not at all necessary. The child's body itself is a living witness to spiritual worlds, and this is where our higher knowledge can begin. Thus, teachers who have right instinct can grow naturally toward treating children in a spiritual way. Our intellectual age, however, has mostly gone away from such a spiritual approach and treats everything rationally. This has happened to the degree that it is said we must educate children, regardless of the stage, to immediately understand what we present. Now, this lends itself to triviality, which is no doubt extremely convenient for teachers. We can do quite a bit in a short time if we present children with as many things as possible in a trivial and rudimentary form and address it to their comprehension. But those who think like this, on rational grounds, are not concerned with the whole course of human life. They are unconcerned about what becomes of the sensations teachers have aroused in children once those children have grown into older men and women, or reached old age. Such people do not consider life. For example, they would not consider it significant if I say that children between the change of teeth and puberty should rely mainly on authority, or that to establish trust they need an example. I might tell a child something that must be taken on trust, since I am the mediator between the divine spiritual world and the child. The child believes me and accepts what I say, but does not yet understand it. We do not understand much of what we receive unconsciously in childhood. If we could accept only what we understood as children, we would receive little of value for later life. And the German poet and thinker Jean-Paul, 1763 to 1825, would never have said that more is learned in the first 3 years of life than in 3 years at a university. Just consider what it means when, say, in your 35th year, some event causes you to feel that something is swimming up into your mind, something heard from a teacher long ago. Perhaps you were only 9 or 10 at the time, and did not understand it at all, and now it comes back. And in the light of your own life, it now makes sense, and you can appreciate it. If during later life you can take something from the depths of your memory and for the first time understand it, you have within yourself a wellspring of life, a refreshing stream of power continually flows within you. When something arises in the soul that was once accepted on trust and is only now understood, we can see that to teach properly, we must not consider only the immediate moment, but the whole of life. In all that we teach children, this must be kept in view. Now, I have just been told that someone took exception to the image I used to show a child how the human being partakes of immortality. I was not speaking of eternity, but of immortality. I said that the image of a butterfly emerging from a chrysalis is there to be seen. This image was used to represent only the sensation we can have when the soul leaves the physical body. The image itself refutes this objection. It was used specifically to meet the argument that the emerging butterfly is not the right concept of immortality. In a logical sense, naturally, it is not a right concept. But we are considering the kind of concept we would give children, an image we would place before their souls to avoid confronting them too early with logic. When we present a picture in this way to a child of 8 or 9, after all, we are speaking of children, not philosophers, it can grow into the correct idea of immortality. Thus it all depends on the what, on having a lively understanding of existence. It is this that our rationalistic age finds so difficult to understand. It must be obvious to anyone that people speak differently to children than they do to adults. What would be the point of saying that a child is unskilled, immature, and childish, if we were in fact talking about an adult? Any observer of life sees not only children and mature youths, but also childish and mature ideas and concepts. As true teachers, it is life itself that we must look to, not adulthood. It seems to me a good fate that it did not fall to me before 1919 to take on the direction of the Waldorf School, which was founded that year by Emil Molt in Stuttgart. I was concerned professionally with education before then, but I would not have felt able to master, relatively speaking, such a great educational enterprise as we are now able to do with our College of Teachers at the Waldorf School. And why is this? Before then, I would never have thought it possible to form such a College of Teachers, of men and women, with such a knowledge of human nature, and thus of child nature, as I was able to do that year. As I said, all true teaching and pedagogy must be based on knowledge of human nature. But before we can do this, we must have a means of penetrating human nature in the proper way. Now, if I may say so, the first perceptions of this understanding of human nature came to me more than 35 years ago. Those were spiritual perceptions of human nature, spiritual, not intellectual. Spiritual truths act in a different way than do intellectual truths. What we perceive intellectually, and have proved, as they say, we can also communicate to others, since the matter is ready when logic is. But spiritual truths are not ready when logic is. It is the nature of spiritual truths that they must be carried with us on our way through life. We must live with them before they can develop fully. I would never have dared to tell others certain truths about human nature as they came to me more than 35 years ago. I never spoke of these things until I wrote titled Riddles of the Soul a few years ago. 30 years lay between the first idea and presenting these things to the world. Why? Because one needs to contemplate such truths at different stages of life. They must accompany one through various phases. The spiritual truths that one conceived as a young man in his early 20s are experienced quite differently than when he reaches his mid-30s or 40s. And as a matter of fact, it was not until I had passed my 50th year that I ventured to publish these outlines of a knowledge of the human being in a book. And only then could I tell these things to a college of teachers, giving them the elements of education that every teacher must claim and use with each and every child. Thus I may say that when my little booklet titled The Education of the Child in the Light of Anthroposophy appeared, I spoke of education as one who disagrees with much in modern education, as one who would like to see this or that treated more fundamentally and the like. But when this little book was written, I would not have been able to undertake anything like directing the Waldorf School. It was essential that such a task have a college of teachers who know that the human being originates in a spiritual world. Such knowledge of the human being is very difficult to acquire today. By comparison, natural science is easy to study. It is relatively easy to realize the nature of the final member of organic evolution. We begin with the simplest organism and see how it has evolved up to the human being, who stands at the summit of evolution, the final member of organic development. But we know the human being only as a product of organic development. We do not see directly into the very being of humankind. Natural science has attained a certain perfection, which we greatly admire and do not intend to disparage. But once we have mastered natural science, we know the human being is the highest animal, but not the most essential nature of humankind. Yet our life is dominated by this natural science. To educate, we need a practical human science that applies to every individual child, for which we need a general human science. Today I will indicate only a few of the principles that became apparent to me more than 30 years ago. We have made these the basis for training the staff at the Waldorf School. Now bear in mind that when we work with elementary school children, 7 to 14, we are concerned with their soul life. In the next few days I will also speak of very small children. But, though it grieves me, we do not yet have a preschool, because we have no money for it, and so we cannot take children until they are 6 or 7 years old. But naturally it would be ideal for children to receive education as early as possible. Once children have passed the age of puberty, they begin an age when we must no longer speak of them as children. This is the age when young men and women fully acquire their own mind and spirit. Thus human beings progress from the body by way of the soul into spirit. As we shall see, however, we cannot teach matters concerning spirit. This must be absorbed freely from the world and from life. When we receive children into elementary school, it is their souls that concern us. That is, their basic physical education has been accomplished or has failed, according to the lights of parents and educators. Thus we can say that the most essential aspect of physical education belongs to the period ending with the change of teeth, though it is continuous, of course, as we shall see when I describe the particular phases of education. From that time on, it is the children's souls that we must work with, and we must direct their development in a way that also strengthens their physical development. When we have elementary school children, we must deal with the soul, which manifests more or less through thinking, feeling, and willing. If we can thoroughly understand the soul life of thought, feeling, and volition within the whole human being, we have the basis for all of education. To be sure, the multiplication table is only a part of mathematics, but we must learn it before we can advance to differential and integral calculus. In education, things are a little different. It is not a wonderfully advanced science that I am about to present, but only the basics. In this case, however, advanced science cannot be built as we would differential and integral calculus on elementary mathematics. Teachers must base it on a practical use of these basic principles. In today's materialistic age, people speak of the nature of the human soul, when they acknowledge the existence of the soul at all, and one even hears of a psychology or science of the soul, though it is completely without soul. And those who allow the existence of the soul usually say that today it is experienced inwardly and intuitively, and that the soul is connected in some way with the body, though I will not get into the philosophical aspect of this. Indeed, when we survey the field of our exceptionally intelligent psychology, we find that it connects the whole soul, thought, feeling, and volition, to the human nervous system in the broadest sense. Accordingly, it is the nervous system that brings the soul to physical manifestation and serves as the material foundation for the soul's life. This is what I recognized as an error 35 years ago. The only part of our soul life as adults, I emphasize adults, since we cannot consider the child until we understand the adult, the only part of our soul life that is connected with the nervous system is our thinking, or power of ideation. The nervous system is connected only with, I'll say it this way, ideation. Human feeling is not related directly to the nervous system, but to what we might call the rhythmic system. It involves the marvelous interrelationship between breathing and the blood's circulation. Their ratio is only approximate, since it naturally varies from person to person. In general, however, every adult has 4 times as many pulse beats as breaths. This internal interplay of pulsing and breathing rhythms is in turn related to the more extended rhythms of human life, and constitutes our rhythmic nature, a second nature in contrast to the head or nerve nature. Our rhythmic system includes the rhythmic experience of sleeping and waking. We often make this pattern non-rhythmic today, but it is a rhythm, and there are many other rhythms in human life. Our life is not built only on the life of the nervous system. It is based also on the rhythmic life. Just as thinking and the forces of thought are related to the nervous system, the power of feeling is directly related to our rhythmic system. Feeling is not expressed directly in the nervous system, but in the rhythmic system. Once we begin to conceive of our rhythmic system and make concepts of our feelings, we can perceive our feelings as ideas by means of the nerves, just as we perceive light or color externally. Thus, the connection between feeling and the nervous system is indirect. Its direct connection is with the rhythmic system. You simply can't understand the human being unless you know we breathe and how this is related to blood circulation. You must understand how this rhythm appears, for example, when a child quickly blushes or grows pale. You must understand everything related to the rhythmic system. On the other hand, you must also know the processes that accompany children's passions, their loves and affections. If you cannot form an idea of what lives directly in the life of rhythm, and how this is merely projected into the life of nerves, you do not know the human being. You do not understand the human being if you think that the soul's nature depends on the nervous system and is merely thinking, which depends on the nerves. What I am talking about arises from direct observation, such as one makes through spiritual perception. There is no proof of the validity of this spiritual observation, as one can prove the findings of intellectual thinking. But anyone who considers these views without bias will be able to prove them retrospectively through normal human understanding, and moreover, through the findings of natural science on these matters. I might add that 35 years ago, I was involved in verifying the original concept of how human nature is made up of various members, which I am speaking of now. Much of the work I had to do involved investigating the domains of physiology, biology, and other natural sciences to discover whether these things could be verified externally. I would not speak of these things today if I had not received this support. In general, it can be stated with certainty that much of what I am saying now can be demonstrated by modern scientific means. Now, in the third place, in contrast to thinking and feeling, we have volition, or our life of will. Volition does not depend directly on the nervous system, but relates directly to human metabolism and movement. Metabolism is very intimately connected with movement. You can regard all human metabolism, in addition to movement itself, to be the limb system. I consider the third member of the human organism to be the movement and metabolic system, and volition is immediately related to this. Every human will impulse is accompanied by a form of metabolic process, whose mode of operation is different from that of the nerve processes that accompany thinking. Of course, people need a healthy metabolism for a sound process of thinking. Thinking is related directly to the activity of our nervous system, which is very different from metabolic activity, while human volition is directly connected with metabolism. We must recognize this dependence of volition on the metabolism. When we think and develop ideas about our own volition, metabolic activity is thus projected into the nervous system. Volition works only indirectly in the nervous system. Events in the nervous system that are related to volition are the faculty of apprehending our own will activity. Thus, when we penetrate the human being with vision, we discover the relationships between human soul and physical nature. The activity of thought in the soul manifests physically as nervous activity. Feeling nature in the soul manifests physically as the rhythms of breathing and blood circulation. It does this directly, not indirectly, through the nervous system. Active volition manifests in physical human nature as a subtle metabolism. It is essential to recognize the fine metabolic processes that accompany the exercise of volition. It is a kind of combustion in the human being. Today I can give you only a general outline of these things, but as you acquire these concepts, their details will become clear in the next few days. I will describe their application, and once you have the elementary principles, your eyes will also be opened to everything that you encounter in the nature of children. In children, things are not yet reached. In children, things have not yet reached the states described. As I explained, for example, a child is entirely a sense organ, specifically all head. It is particularly interesting to use scientific, spiritual observation to see how a child tastes in a different way than does an adult. Adults have brought taste into the realm of consciousness. They taste something with the tongue and decide what that taste is. A baby, during the earliest weeks, tastes with the whole body, because the organ of taste is diffused throughout the organism. A baby tastes with the stomach and continues to taste as the nourishing juices are absorbed in the lymph system and transmitted throughout the organism. When babies nurse, they are completely permeated by taste. And here we see how the child is, so to speak, illuminated and transfused with taste, with something of a soul nature. Later on, we no longer have this in our body as a whole, but only in our head. Thus we learn how to watch a tiny child and how to watch an older child, knowing that one child will blush easily for one reason or another, and another will easily turn pale. One is quick to get excited or moves the arms and legs quickly. One child walks firmly while another walks lightly. Once we have these principles and recognize that the soul's expression of volition is seated in the metabolic system, that the expression of feeling rests in the rhythmic system, that what manifests in the soul as thought is based in the nervous system, then we will know how to observe children. We will know where to look. You all know that there are those who use a microscope to investigate certain things. They see wonderful things in this way. There are also people who have not learned how to look through a microscope. They look into it, and no matter how they manipulate it, they see nothing. First, one must learn to see by learning how to manipulate the instrument through which one sees. Once a person has learned how to look through a microscope, one is able to see what is needed. People see nothing of the human being until they have learned to see with the soul and spirit all that corresponds to thinking, feeling, and volition. The goal of the Waldorf School has been to develop the correct orientation of vision in the staff. Teachers must first know what goes on in children. Then they can achieve the right state of mind. and the right education comes only from the right mental attitude. It was necessary to begin with an account of the threefold human organization, so that you will more readily understand the details of practical educational methods. The end of Lecture 3.